This podcast was recorded at the Facing History in Ourselves Day of Learning, Thought, Judgment, Action, Choosing to Participate. This talk contains helpful visuals. Watch the video at facinghistory.org. This talk is from the session Learning from History and features Anthony Appiah, Professor of Philosophy at New York University and Chair of the Facing History Board of Scholars.
I want to talk about one lever, which I think, actually I do say lever now, I've become American, so what the heck. One very powerful lever, I want to talk about it, and I want to talk about it historically, which is what we do here. But in order to set it up, I need to just introduce some conceptual material, because I'm a philosopher as well as a historian. So I want to talk about honor. Now, honor is easy to define, I think, though it took a long time for me to see what the correct definition was. Honor is about rights to respect. So to have honor is to be entitled to respect. And what different societies have different views about what entitles you to respect, and so what gets you honor is different in different places, and also what loses you respect and leads to shame is different in different places. But everywhere in the world, every human society has notions of how to assign respect on the basis of codes. So that's what we call honor codes. And so I think you can talk about honor pretty much everywhere. And one really interesting thing about honor is that it can be individual, but it can also be collective. You can gain honor from things done by people with whom you share an identity. The pride you feel when the United States does something good, that's because you're sharing in the national honor. And the shame you feel when the United States does something bad, that's, you didn't do anything, right? But you can still feel shame because of it. And you can feel that you've lost your country's lost a certain right to respect. Honor is a right to respect. And that can make you feel bad. And when it does something that entitles us to respect as Americans, that can make us feel good. So now, it isn't just national identity that can do this. You can feel proud as a woman because of something a woman has done. You can feel proud as a black person because of something that a black person has done. You can feel proud as a Jew because a Jewish person has done something of significance, and so on. There are lots of ways in which identity can generate this sense of shared respect. So that's the background here. I want to talk about the role of national honor as one of the levers for thinking about how to bring about moral change. But I want to begin by conceding something which is really important that I have to concede at the start, which is that honor is perfectly capable of being mobilized to do terrible things. So you can't trust honor always to be on the right side. And later on, I'm going to tell some historical story about one instance of this, which has to do with what is actually called honor killing, which is the murdering of mostly women because they've brought, as people say, brought shame or brought dishonor to their families. And you can bring dishonor to your family in many societies, for example, both historically and today, by being raped. That is, by having something terrible happen to you. And you can be killed by your own family because your having been raped has brought dishonor to your family. So this is a thing that's kind of hard to understand. And I'm going to talk about it in relation to Pakistan, not because I have anything against Pakistan, but because it happens to be the country, according to the UN, where there are more of these than any other in the world today. But I should point out that this was a common practice all over the Mediterranean world. When it was a Christian practice, it was a Muslim practice as well. It was not specifically Muslim practice, it was a Mediterranean practice, and it happens to have been mostly stamped out in Europe, but it occurred in Europe well into the 20th century in many places, in Christian societies. But so I want to begin by conceding that. It can go terribly wrong. And now I want to switch, as it were, to the good news. The good news, I think, is that if you think about certain important cases where historically people in one society have been able to influence moral development in another society, it turns out that honor can be one of the instruments positive instruments in that process. And I want to consider with you, this is the one of the history examples, the case of the way in which foot binding came to an end in China. Now, I don't know, do you all know about foot binding? So so I don't need to remind you of just how horrible it was, or how painful it was, or how extraordinary it was that for 1,000 years in China, little girls, 2-3 years old, had their feet treated in a way that was crippling as an aesthetic exercise in order to make them more beautiful. It's hard to make sense of, though it's important to try and understand when people do these things, because otherwise you can't figure out how to stop them. So, how did foot binding come to an end? Well, you've got to understand the context. The context is it's China, it's the late 19th century. China has been subjected over since the Opium Wars of the 1840s to constant incursions by Europe, and then as Japan, Meiji Japan developed by Japan, and the foreigners always won. Right? So they're constantly under pressure from the outside. And this is particularly distressing to them, as it would be to anybody, but it's distressing to them in particular because they have this sense of themselves as a superior civilization, as these other people as barbarians. When George III, whom we love so much in this country, when George III sent his first ambassador to Beijing, there's a very comical letter that he brought back from the emperor, expressing his puzzlement at how this small king from the other side of the world could bring him anything worth having. He says, "Thank you very much. It's very kind for these gifts, but actually we have all these things already. We don't understand, why would we want to have relations with you?" But they soon discovered that they had to, because the British were able to force opium on the Chinese. The Opium Wars were started because the Chinese emperor sensibly wanted to stop opium coming into his country because it was doing terrible harm. And the British said, in the name of free trade, you have to take it. We're going to send a navy until you take it. So anyway, they were beaten over and over again. And they had to think about why. They had to analyze, we're a great civilization, how come they keep beating us? And one of the things that helped them was the fact that as a result of these losses, there were inside China for the first time significant numbers of foreigners who were there imposed upon them, and they were Catholic and Protestant missionaries, and there were business people, mostly on the coast, who were there to do things like bring opium. And these some of these foreigners, especially Protestant missionaries, became profoundly respectful of Chinese civilization. So they learned beautiful Chinese. Some of them dressed like mandarins, like literati. They learned to write fine Chinese. They published newspapers in Chinese. And they showed that these foreigners who had been coming in and beating them in all these wars also had among them people who loved and respected things about China. And so they built relationships. And when the Chinese, when the Christian missionaries, these mostly Protestant missionaries, began organizing against foot binding, which they thought was a terrible thing, they did it, the people who were most influential and successful were the ones who said, "We love China, we don't understand how you, whom we respect, could be doing this thing." They spoke not with contempt, but with respect. And so after the founding of the first anti-foot binding societies, which were founded by evangelical Christian missionaries, and then a second round organized by European and American women who were the wives of businessmen on the coast, so there was another round, and they did brilliant things because they got literati to make beautiful classical arguments against foot binding, and then they published them and circulated them. Again, they used the local language, which they respected, the local conceptual vocabulary, to make their case. And then this was what really was important. Finally, people like one of my heroes, a man called Kang Yuwei, began to organize Chinese anti-foot binding societies. And it's very interesting to think about how Kang Youwei made his arguments. And his most powerful and impressive, I think, argument was made in the 1890s in a memorandum to the emperor. It went to the empress, actually, since the emperor was... Well, actually, it went to the emperor because he was briefly in charge. But most of the time, the Dowager Empress was actually running China. He made the arguments in this memorandum, written in the beautiful classical essay form in which all these memos were written. And what's fascinating about this memorandum, this memorial, as they were called, is that it just begins and ends with the question of national honor and national shame. So it begins by saying, I'm using a translation, I don't know Chinese, by a woman called Virginia Chow. He says, it's a shame for China to have such a barbarous custom which makes it a laughingstock in the eyes of foreigners. That's how he starts. And at the end, the last words of the memorandum are, it has become a subject of ridicule to foreigners. It is therefore intolerable. So he's focused. He makes many arguments in his memorandum. Some of them are practical arguments. We should stop foot binding because the foreigners keep invading us and our women can't run away because women whose feet aren't bound are going to be healthier. They're going to have stronger children. That'll be good for the army, he says. So he makes lots of arguments, but he begins and ends with the question of national honor. And others did too. Lang Qichao, who's another of the leading Chinese progressive intellectuals at the turn of the century, wrote at about the same time, it seems that this ridiculous custom has flourished generation after generation against imperial prohibition, and we have become the laughingstock of foreigners. So this idea that we're losing the respect of the world because of this. Now, so the story is obviously more complicated than that. Many other things are going on. But the fact is, at the heart of this, over and over again, you see this concern for national respect. And I think the end of foot binding shows how a concern for national honor, that is, remember my definitions, that's a concern for the entitlement to respect of your nation, for your nation to be entitled to respect, can play a crucial role, did play a crucial role in this case, in bringing people like Kang Youwei to feel that they must work to change their countrymen and women. And this was, as I say, this was an example of successful influence from outside. It had to be nationalized, it had to be taken on board by the Chinese themselves if it was going to work, but it began with these outsiders. And it began with these outsiders speaking respectfully, not setting out to shame them. The shame was something that happened, but they weren't trying to shame them. They were just saying, you're a great civilization. What are you doing this? So, and in fact, that's an important point because I want to tell you another story now, because national honor is a very sensitive matter, and you can try to shame people, and it can backfire very badly. This is a point about backlash. So let me tell you a story about honor killing. It's a relatively recent story. It's 1989. A woman named Samia Sawa is married in Pakhtunkhwa, which is in what used to be called the Northwest Frontier Province of Pakistan. Father throws a grand wedding. He's a modern, successful guy. He's a Pashtun. He goes on to serve two terms as president of the Chamber of Commerce in Peshawar, which is the big town in that part of the world. His wife's a doctor. Samia herself is going to be a law student. Her sister's going to be a doctor too. These are modern, successful Pashtun people. And they have this grand wedding with the governor and representatives of the central government and so on. But the marriage doesn't go well. And so pretty soon into it, he's an abusive husband. And pretty soon into it, she says to her parents, I can't live with this guy. And they say, that's fine, you don't have to live with him. But you can't divorce him. Why? Well, because if you divorce him, that will be a stain on our family honor. That will take away our kairat. This is the Pashtun word for honor. And if that happens, your sister can't marry anybody. We can't be seen in public, and so on and so on. So the deal is, you don't have to live with him, but you don't get a divorce. Well, this goes on for 10 years later. She falls in love with somebody else. She runs away. She goes to to Lahore. Her parents are on the Hajj in Mecca because they're devout Muslims. And she finds a lawyer. She's a law student herself, but she finds a lawyer. And she, in fact, a very distinguished lawyer, one of the two most distinguished women lawyers in Pakistan, Hina Jilani. And she gets her to negotiate with the family, and they eventually agree to her being allowed to have a divorce. But the mother says she has to come and talk to her about it in the lawyer's office, and that Samia says, yes, but you can't bring my father, because I don't trust, I don't know, I'm too scared of him. And you can't bring any men. And she arrives with a driver, and she says she needs somebody to support her, so the driver comes in with her and pulls a gun and shoots her in her lawyer's office in front of her mother, and she's dead. Now, that's an honor killing. So they hadn't, in fact, conceded that she should be allowed to divorce, and they would rather that she was dead, and so her mother brings a guy to kill her. Panic ensues. In fact, the murderer was killed by a security guard at the time. But nobody's ever charged with any crime, even though all these facts are well known. And one of the most astonishing things about all this is that since this is illegal in Pakistan, it's not like it's okay. You'd have thought not only that something would be done about it, but also that people would rise up and protest. And some people did. Benazir Bhutto objected, and there were protests by young women and some men. But there was an attempt in the Senate of Pakistan to pass a motion of censure on the family. They couldn't get it. Couldn't get more than four votes, so they couldn't actually get the thing done. So, and in Pakhtunkhwa, in the northwest frontier itself, there's terrible indignation that these outsiders have had the temerity to intervene. So, and part of what they say is these people are just representing the voice of foreigners, which they were, because foreigners were appalled too. So in this case, the foreign outside force is counterproductive. So if you're going to intervene, you have to do it in the way that the anti-foot-binding people did, and you don't want to do it in this crude way. And the fundamental thing that's distinctive about the success of the foot-binding movement, in my view, is, as I say, that the people who were at the heart of it began not with contempt for the people they were trying to influence, but with respect. And I just want to make one final point about the difficulty that this fact poses for us in the world today, which is that some of our most intense moral feeling is about things going on in parts of the Muslim world in respect of gender, but we don't have the background of the respectful conversation within which I believe these kinds of productive interventions can occur. We need to develop, in other words, a respectful background of conversation, a sense that we actually understand something about Islam. And the fact is that most people in the Muslim world, of course, being people who do not support terrorism and don't want to blow up buildings in the United States, most people in the United States think that we are, outside the United States and the Muslim world, think we are Islamophobic. And I have to say that though I try myself very hard not to be, that's a pretty fair generalization, not just about this country, but about Western Europe. And until, as long as that's true, this lever is unavailable to us because we don't have the background of respectful conversation.
To learn more about this podcast and other Facing History resources, please visit our website at facinghistory.org. People make choices. Choices make history. Facing history in ourselves.